listening to Fatherhood for the Rest of Us with Brandon Handley. Because you're already great at everything else, why not fatherhood too?
Hey there, Fatherhood for the Rest of Us. I am on today with Sally Spencer-Thomas, and she is a clinical psychologist, inspirational international speaker, and an impact entrepreneur. Dr. Spencer-Thomas was moved to work in suicide prevention after her young brother, a Denver entrepreneur, died of a suicide after a difficult battle with bipolar condition. Known nationally and internationally as an innovator in social change, Spencer-Thomas has helped start up multiple large-scale gap-filling efforts in mental health, including the award-winning campaign Man Therapy and the nation's first initiative for suicide prevention in the workplace. In 2016, she was invited to the White House to speak. In her recent TEDx talk, she shares her goal to elevate the conversation to make suicide prevention a health and safety priority in our schools, workplaces, and communities. Dr. Sally, thanks for being on here today with me. And before we get going on anything, is there something that we can help you celebrate today?
Oh, that's a great question. Spring.
Yes.
Yay. Okay. So I live on the top of a mountain in Conifer, Colorado. It's a little dirt road, winds up. And it's been cold and sad. So today definitely feels like spring. We're running around outside without our coats on. I know it'll only last like a day, and then we'll get dumped on, but spring.
Awesome. Awesome. How long have you been down there in Colorado?
I moved out here, sorry to say, I was born in Connecticut, but not a New Englander. Mm. I moved out to Denver in 1990, and I remember getting off the plane to go to my interview at University of Denver for graduate school, and angels descended, and I was like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. I didn't know. So I love it here, and everybody in my family has transplanted out here. Sorry, all the native Coloradans who hate that, but whatever. You got a great state. You're going to attract people.
right. No, it's absolutely gorgeous down there. Absolutely gorgeous. Your TEDx talk, by the way, I think I cried almost the whole time.
Oh, like, I think I did too. I was buzzing in my ear. I'm like, oh no, I worked so hard on this and it's falling apart, but you can't. Outside.
Nah, it was very well done and like very moving. You had some humor in there, but obviously this is something that's near and dear to your heart, and it's something that you're working with a passion. And let's just kind of dive right into it.
Sure.
For those that don't know kind of what you're about, what we're getting into here, let's give it to them. The about the men's mental health and the suicide prevention.
Sure. So I had been in the field of mental health about 16 years when my brother died of suicide. And there's a long backstory there, and I'll share a little bit of it. But it was a huge wake-up call to me that really pushed my whole reason for being, my whole kind of why I'm on this planet, motivation that has kind of followed me for the last almost 14 years. My brother was one of these people on the planet. I call him a magical person. He had the spark and the light and the charisma and the humor. He'd just be the light of any room. We called him the Pied Piper. Everybody would just follow him around. He was that guy, handsome and athletic and all that stuff. And then in his adult years, very successful with his businesses, and he had a beautiful family. But he also had a lot of masks he wore of got it all together and powerful business decision kind of guy. And he also had a lot of inner demons around bipolar condition. So while he's, projecting all this strength and decisiveness, and he would have many a night that he was holed up in his basement, just filled with self-loathing or anxiety or all kinds of really difficult emotions. And he would often self-medicate with alcohol or marijuana, whatever he could used to kind of quell it, and then he'd feel better, and then he'd go back out. And he also tried a bunch of different regular kinds of treatments like medication and talk therapy. I mean, he really did work hard over the course of his life to find something to feel better. But he could never really reconcile having a mental health condition with kind of how he saw himself as a man. And I think that's true for a lot of people, and not just men, but a lot of people, that's kind of a hard one to kind of integrate. He just didn't want to be sick. He didn't want to be broken. And, for the most part, he was exceptional, just an exceptional person. And you had bipolar condition, for those of you who aren't familiar with all the ins and outs of it, it's what we call a spectrum disorder, which means there's really intense forms and less intense forms, and people can move up and down and in and off the spectrum all the time. So for the most part, my brother was on the low end of the spectrum, and the upswing of his mood was delightful. He was just funny and productive and visionary and creative and all the good things. That's where all his gifts lie. But the depression was pretty devastating. So that's where he would get treatment, and then when he felt better, he'd go off stuff and go back to his high-energy self. The summer of 2004 was something completely different. So rather than just kind of this elevated mood state, he went into full-blown mania and wrecked his life completely in a matter of months. Just left his family, blew up his business, was erratic and really huge risk-taking. All bad decisions. And all of us in the inner circle kind of rallied around him, super worried, you know, just for example, I mean, this is totally, he was always kind of a risk taker. It's part of what being an entrepreneur and all that stuff. But in October of 2014, he drove to DIA, Denver International Airport, got on a plane with no coat and spent $1,000 to take a flight to Chicago, like that kind of stuff. So we were really worried, but there's not a whole lot you can do when adults are making bad decisions. We get the right to mess up our lives as long as we're not hurting anybody else or threatening to hurt ourselves. So that's kind of the space we were in for months. And then his accountant said, "You're broke." Hmm. And he woke up one morning and he had no more money and he could get no more money. And that was a huge turning point. And I honestly think that he was estranged from most of his family during that period of time because of his irritability and anger and horrific decision making. But after that turning point, he came back to us. And I honestly think in hindsight, he was just coming back to say goodbye. Hmm. So we had about 2 weeks with him and we just swarmed him with love and resources and support. And the last time I saw him, you know, we were talking about stuff and he was just having just all kinds of challenges with everything. And I just read a book, The Unquiet Mind, with the rest of the family. And it chronicles the life of a woman who's also a super high achiever. And she had gone through something similar and she'd gotten treatment and she'd gotten well. And I said, "Look, Carson, here's another person who's gone through something similar." And today we have a lot more of these stories, but back in 2004, not many. Certainly not many, you know, highfalutin businessmen talking about this kind of stuff. So he didn't have any role models. But I said, here's this woman. She's done something similar. And he said, "Sally, it's madness." And 4 days later, he was gone. Right. So I just feel like he lost hope that he couldn't get his life back after having such a very public episode of mania, which is just crushing.
What I can't imagine, just because it's never happened to me, right? But I can only imagine how devastating that is as a family, right? Being a close one and not being able to help make them stop, right? Especially, you know, kind of being in your position, right? With what it is that you do.
Yeah.
So I could just feel, I think that's probably why I cried the whole time practically listening to your TED talk, just because that's how I felt. I could just feel like that. I could feel that energy. You talk about like all the bad decisions, right? And you talk about where he got to. And, you know, I can imagine too, anyone having the potential to get there, right? Anyone going, you know, anyone being able to say, "Listen, sure, I've led a successful life," and anything could flip the switch. It doesn't necessarily have to be somebody with bipolar. We talk to all kinds of people, especially men that go through the quote unquote midlife crisis or any other labeling. Is there a recovery, like, you know, from there, like somebody gets there, where can we point to somebody that, "Listen, so many people dashed upon the shore just like you have and stood up and recovered"? Like, what is that process like? What does that look like?
Yeah, this is what gives me hope, because I swear if my brother had just one person like him who said, "Oh yeah, you should have seen me, you know, the fall of 2010. You know, I spent some time in the hospital, but you know what happened? I learned this thing and this happened, and you know what? You'd never know it today because I've got all these tools and I figured out how to regulate the thing and whatever." if he had just one person who said, oh, yeah, I went through it and I'm better, he'd be here. I swear he'd be here. But he thought he was the only one. And he thought having a mental illness was so far from who he was that he just didn't want to go on. So your question is, where do we find them? It's still a little hard to find people, but it's not impossible. There are various groups that are cultivating the ability for people to share stories and then go out into their community. And probably, I don't know this for sure, but I think the group that's been doing it the longest is probably NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. They have a program called In Our Own Voice, where they help people who've lived with various mental health conditions shape very positive stories of hope and recovery, and then go into various community forums to put a face to a diagnosis. You know, people have all these strange ideas, especially given a lot of the coverage in our major media of what this looks like. And it's really actually just one in five people you come in with contact with every single day. It looks like all of us. And yes, there's various forms of intensity, and there's various forms of all the kinds of ways that it shows up. But all we tend to see, especially on the news, are the most extreme examples that are pretty that feel pretty hopeless. So NAMI's one. There's another group that's really special called This Is My Brave. And think of it like a TED Talk-esque event, except everybody who's there up on stage is someone who's been through some kind of recovery. So it could be addiction, it could be a mental health condition, it could be a suicide attempt, could be grief. And they're up there, you know, just like the TED Talkers do, bravely and powerfully telling their story. So I'm one of my main missions now is to really help cultivate that even farther, and especially in places where it's still fairly taboo, like the workplace. And various places where these conversations aren't happening, but certainly people living with them are right there. They just don't know that there's many of them in the room together. So I'm working with a group called United Suicide Survivors International, and we're working on an online course that helps people move from, should I tell my story? What is my why? Is this the right time? Like, go through all that discernment thing. Is this the right time? Am I solid enough in my recovery that this is good? What are the potential consequences and benefits for me, as well as other people in my story? And so to kind of walk them through that thinking process and then coach them around safely and effectively sharing their story, and then what to do with their story once they got it.
Navigating telling the story. That's a great spot there. But even before there for a second, it's just a matter of them feeling safe. And the deal in the space that I'm at with working with fathers and talking to dads and establishing open communications with men, which isn't it's I think more prevalent now, and it could just be more that I'm seeing it more just simply because I surround myself in it.
Sure.
I'm going to probably go with two questions here. One is, have you seen a rapid rise over the time that you've worked in it where that communication is more acceptable? That is just men on men having those open conversations, and then kind of tie into the a little bit of what does it look like to navigate that conversation? Because to me, if the opportunity is, if I tell my story today and it saves somebody's lives, then me holding back is almost catastrophic.
That's a lot of weight to put on a shoulder. So let me get your first question. Are we seeing some increase in this? And my first comment is, you know, the fatherhood groups were one of the first to come to the table. And they gravitated to this program called Man Therapy that I'll talk about later. But they seemed really hungry for it, hungry for a place to talk about depression or just challenges of being a dad and the transition into that role and all of that stuff. And so they sucked it up. And one person in any system, in any culture, who is that bold one to say, of course, me too, who hasn't been brought to their knees at some point in their life by something overwhelming? We all have. So let's talk about it. And if you get that one person, especially if they have what I call that vicarious credibility vibe, you know, oh my gosh, you know, that kind of experience,
right.
Ooh, like dominoes start to fall like mad. So I think that's part of it, is that we've had a number of folks bravely step up. So Michael Phelps, and it's different, I think, when it's celebrities, but they certainly are helping. You know, when really incredibly high-performing folks step up, it starts the conversation. But when it's your peer, someone just like you, that you know in all these other circles, in all these other ways, and they disclose to you, that really gets things rolling. So we are seeing an uptick in not only disclosure, but I would say momentum around men's mental health. I think another place it started early is within military circles, and I'm well aware that military is comprised of men and women, but in many circles it's predominantly men, where this kind of conversation was taboo. And then, you know, the Marines and the Army in particular, and the Air Force, they looked at their data and they're like, oh my gosh, our folks are dying by suicide, you know, and here they're willing to give up their lives to protect our country. Let's do something about it. So some of these infrastructure things have helped. Some kind of the brave forerunners have helped. And I think the younger generation of men just don't have as much hang-ups about it. You know, they don't have as much hang-ups about a whole bunch of stuff that the older folks have hang-ups about. So I think that trend will continue to grow.
I love that concept. But and just because I'm getting older now, I'm like, have we helped pave the way, or have they braved it?
Ooh, nice. I think probably both are happening. But yes, I think many men have paved the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just. You know, I guess, like I said, I'm just getting older now. I'm like, well, listen, we accept you for who you are, so keep doing what you're doing, right? And nobody's trying to squash like what somebody's really feeling. And I agree that it's also brave, right, for them to be able to do that. And when I say them, I'm just saying like younger generations. But it's something that it's a trigger.
That's great. So the other question, hold on, I had it and I lost it. Oh, navigating the story. Mm-hmm. So I really do believe it's everybody's personal decision to disclose or not to disclose and how much to disclose. And when I talked about weighing those pros and cons, there are definite things on both sides. You know, the obvious benefit is if you are able to help one person, then, you know, your disclosure saved a life. That's pretty remarkable. Or you help them take another step towards having a more fulfilling life. You know, maybe they weren't thinking about suicide, but they were pretty miserable, and you help them be less miserable. And then the benefits to you directly, it feels really good to be unburdened by a secret, and to connect with other people in a very vulnerable and powerful way. So you actually do your own wellness a huge boost when you do this kind of thing. But on the downside, I don't want to underplay the fact that discrimination and prejudice are still alive and kicking out there. And in our day and age, once your story's out, you can't get it back. So to be thoughtful on the front end of you're the one who's in control of your narrative. You're the one who gets to decide, I share this, I don't share this. This is my truth, mine, and this is how I want to talk about it. You know, all of that, that's in your control. And to think through, you know, 5 or 6 years from now, what that's going to mean for you, for maybe parental rights or job prospects or political aspirations, because there's people out there that'll use this kind of stuff against you. And there's ways to position your story that is entirely around resilience and strength. And then the other piece is just know that, you know, hardly anybody's story is in isolation of just them. There's almost always other people in the story, family members, therapists, friends, bosses, whomever, and nobody sees truth in the same way. So do you have conversations with those people before you share your story, saying, I'm going to talk about this, is that okay? Do you make their parts unidentifiable so people don't know that you're talking about those people in particular? I mean, there's all kinds of things to think through before you get up on that stage with that microphone being, you know, tape recorded by a million cameras. That's the part that I think is super important, and it's often skipped over.
No, and that's all great stuff. I mean, I think that's wonderful that, you know, you're helping others to navigate that, to help them think through it instead of just letting it, you know, kind of crash the dam, I guess, as it were. The
I did one more thing because I forgot to leave it out. And it's important. People also underestimate the fact when they start putting their story together that they have to go into that dark forest again and look under some bushes that they haven't looked under for a long time. And they might rediscover stuff that they were trying to forget. And that can be very disruptive. So I also tell people, like, prepare yourself emotionally for putting your hero's journey together, because it can and it actually should be an emotional journey to kind of look back at where you've been to where you are now. So, you know, if you're a person in recovery from addiction, make sure your sponsor's got a heads up. Or if you have a therapist, give them like, hey, I'm going to be working on this thing. I might want to need some extra sessions here or there, or your best friend or whomever. Just give people a little bit of notice that this is something that's happening for you.
Get some support.
Yeah.
Get some support for sure. So that's what I was going to ask was, and you talked about bringing this kind of into the workplace, and I'm going to tie this to, you know, maybe now, or even if we go back like to 2004, where we weren't having these conversations, to where we are now, where we're having more of these conversations, and we're trying to look at it less as an aberration and more of just like a condition, kind of like a cold, except for maybe more severe. I don't know how to really navigate that. But like, instead of saying, oh man, that person's a mess, just be like, that's that person's condition. And we're going to work with it. They've got, you cited a number of strengths that your brother had, right? And all these other people that kind of have like some of these debilitating moments have way, like the strengths and the good outweighs those moments. So what's it looking like there? Like you said, you're getting into bringing it to the workplace. What's that look like? And what's the response been?
Different in different spaces. Almost immediately after Carson died, well, literally on the night that he died, my brother's good friend from Atlanta, a business partner and a dear friend, called my brother's wife and said, you know, oh my God, what could I do? And she said, just don't let him be forgotten. So it was literally on the night that he died, this friend just started churning. We got to do something. And, you know, a month later, he had all my brother's closest friends from across his lifespan on the phone, and my parents and me, and we were just talking, mostly stories about my brother, but every once in a while we would be like, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to do some gap filling work. We're going to make sure that whatever happened to Carson wasn't going to happen to any other people. Now, again, I'm 16 years in, tons of training, tons of graduate school, all this stuff. No one ever told me. Now, this is much more part of the conversation today, but no one ever told me. No one was trained about the fact that my brother was completely the prototypical person to die of suicide. A white working-aged man. Now, those of us in the inner circles of this work know that very well at this point, but the general public still thinks it's the at-risk youth kid, and it's not. It's white working-aged men. So it seemed to me that we were totally missing the boat, and if we were going to reach kids through this work, through schools, we're going to reach people in their working-aged years in the workplace. So we were super excited to create something new that hadn't been done before. There had been some mental health stuff in workplaces, but suicide is... it overlaps, and there's some differences in the fact that many mental health people don't utter the word suicide. That's how taboo it is. So we were very excited, again, a long time ago, 2007, ta-da, we got suicide prevention in the workplace curriculum and all these best practices that we gathered from other parts of the world. And it was crickets, like nobody cared. And it was so disheartening to say, you know, it doesn't take much, money, doesn't take much effort to save the life of someone who is struggling in your workplace. Like, why aren't you doing this? And again, it's all the stigma and taboo stuff. It was about 2012.
So did you ask that question? Why aren't you doing this?
I did. And you know what I got back? You know, Sally, no one has ever died of suicide at our workplace ever. And I was like, yes, dying on a work site is a rare event. Huh. It has tripled, you know, in a short period of time, but it's a rare event. Most people die at home or in some other place. Doesn't mean that their death didn't affect your workplace or that you couldn't have done something in your workplace to prevent it. I think people just wanted to wash their hands of the darkness of it. Mm-hmm. And when people are thinking of suicide, it's not evident to most people around them. You know, they don't see it like a cast or something, you know, so people can put on the mask while they go to work and kind of hide from everybody. So it's not something that managers or bosses were seeing a lot of.
I mean, if you don't mind, you brought it up, I think, in one of your podcasts that like you were going through a little bit of a depressed state, right? Where you just buried yourself in your work. I mean, that's where you go. That's where you go to hide.
Totally. And that's what I'm good at. So for little moments, I would be like, okay, that felt good for a second there. Let me just keep doing that. And, but meanwhile, so many pieces of my world were just crumbling. Right. And what I didn't have insight to until I went through it myself, I just read about it, right? So when you go through it, you realize like your brain is literally not functioning the way you're used to it functioning. So you can actually, I'm used to like, okay, I got a problem, I got to solve it. Well, here's a solution. Like all of a sudden my brain will go, turn around and give me all these ideas. When you're depressed, it's like, this stops. It just stops.
Right.
So not only does it just kind of stop creating you some good ideas, it fills you with dread and it immobilizes you. And then it takes away every single tiny bit of pleasure that you have. So I was like, I remember, like I couldn't taste food, which is weird because I love food.
Food's great.
I know. And I couldn't hear birds chirp. And I remember the day that I first heard, I'm like, oh, that's a bird. It was like feeling so like spring, like coming out of the darkness. Mm-hmm. So I have a much deeper, profound respect for when people are in the throes of it about how hard it is, to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I was trying. I was doing everything I could, the things I knew to cope, and nothing was working.
I find that, I say interesting just because I don't have a better word right off the top of my tongue. To know what to do, but you couldn't do it. Is that kind of sum it up?
Partly. So what I tried to do, like I said, I said, I know I have to eat. Okay. But I would choke down. I remember one of my saddest days, I was traveling. I was still like zipping it up and putting the mask on and going out on stage and presenting. But then I'd come back to my hotel room and just go, and I remember like, I have to eat. I need energy to do this kind of thing. And I was sitting in this little Thai restaurant with this little cup of broth with squares of tofu in it. And I just couldn't even swallow it. So I knew
tofu, of course you could.
I knew I had to eat. I knew I had to eat, sleep, and exercise. So those were my go-to, and they still are my go-to strategies for coping with stress. And I couldn't do any of them, none of them. The part that I missed, because the conspiracy of business is all about me, right? I was like, oh, just gotta stay busy. The part I missed was seeking medication, honestly, and that was the turning point for me. I'd never taken medication before, but after a number of nights of just agitated, no sleep, extreme anxiety, it was my father who said, sweetheart, go take your own advice, call your doctor. I was like, oh, and that was one part of the turning point, sleeping, honestly. Sleeping is so core to so much of our health, and it's directly related to suicidal thoughts. The longer you go with not sleeping well, the more likely you are to have suicidal thoughts, no intervening other variables, direct connection. So that was important just to be able to sleep again. And then the other was in the middle of all that, I went to my professional association, and I was in bad shape, and I had all these professional obligations and expectations, and I disclosed to a couple people, I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing too good. And they loved me. They're like, we don't care if you need to do this thing or not do this thing. We love you for you. And they just surrounded me with like that unconditional, you don't have to be doing this work, but still we're gonna love you. We're gonna love you. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna be okay.
let's hit on that right there. Is just the ability to admit your condition, and then being accepted by others as again not being crazy,
right?
Right, and just people saying, all right, well, that's where you're at right now. Where do you need us?
Right. That's exactly it. Everybody gets worried that they have to say the magic thing or do the magic thing. And honestly, it's 95% showing up and maybe not saying anything horrific, but 95% just showing up and checking in and following up. And I'm thinking about you. And in our little research world, we call it non-demand caring contacts. We always got to put these fancy labels on things, but that's the deal. Okay. Little tiny touches I love you. I'm thinking about you. I remember the fun time we did the thing. I'm sending this funny cat video to you. You know, whatever it is.
Right.
Little tiny touches over and over and over again. Just miracles.
And were you going through this with, like, your family? You've got you're married with a couple children, right?
I have three teenage boys. Woohoo! But at the time, this was 2012. Yeah, I had a perfect storm. I had a jaw surgery, so I couldn't eat, and that made me cranky. Computer that crashed. A dog had a stroke. I had a massive, like, several massive work blowups, and I can cope with a lot. But then all of a sudden, my brain went, and we're done. And I watched myself, like, circling the toilet bowl, and I went, this is different.
Well, not used to this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another thing, too. I mean, you talked about your brother kind of feeling like maybe he was broken, right? Or being seen as broken. Is that how you saw yourself for a moment until, like, you were able to just voice it to someone and then they just accepted you for how you were? Or is that if not you, is that generally how others perceive it?
So I didn't see myself as broken from a mental health perspective. I saw myself as broken as a failed entrepreneur. Yes. And that was crushing because I had started this thing in my brother's legacy. Mm-hmm. And I had made it pretty damn successful. And then it started to crash. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have all these mouths to feed, all my employees and my family. And I made this commitment to the funder and I'm failing there. But most importantly, like, I'm failing my brother. Like, this is what I was supposed to do to honor him. And so all of the messaging that I got in there was like, Sally, welcome to the world of entrepreneurship. This is how it goes.
A whole lot of thanks there.
No, but it was helpful. Like, you know, again, that you're not alone. Many of us have been through this. Yeah. Like, and the fact that you're worthy, and the fact that you can love your brother no matter what you do. I was like, all right, yeah. So this last time, I mean, the business did end up going belly up a year ago, July. I didn't have any of those reactions. I was like, you know what? I can honor him whatever way I want to. I remember this lesson from 2012.
Wow.
So,
well, I mean, that speaks to your resilience with it, right? And that's awesome.
Well, and that's one of the messages, I think, throughout this whole thing is the, you know, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey is exactly where it's at. Like, nobody gets out of this life without, you know, going into that dark forest. Everybody's got these really overwhelming things that happen to them. And it's what we take out of that experience that helps us on the other side. And maybe it's empathy, or maybe it's insight, or maybe it's a spiritual awakening, or something. And that's the gift that we get, that we help others with or improve our life with, that we wouldn't have had if we hadn't gone through it.
Right.
Now, while I would never wish a suicide of a loved one on anyone, there's many of us out there every day that are kind of carrying the torch for this cause because we don't want our loved ones to die in vain. And we've always been at the core of this movement. And this would not have happened without lost survivors saying, we need to do something different here.
Right. Right. You talk about going into schools, talk about going to work, and as fathers, we, of course, want to be sure that we're paying ultra attention to our children. How can we teach mental resilience in our own children?
Oh, that's a great question, and I also realize I didn't fully answer your other question about how is this happening in workplaces, so we'll come back to this in a second. I think that, just like everything parents do, the number one best way we can model it is to teach it is to model it. Mm-hmm. And that means to be also authentic when things aren't going well. And, you know, there's a lot of private kinds of struggles that parents and couples have that kids don't need to be privy to, but just the understanding that, you know, every day isn't our best day. And sometimes, especially I think when it comes off as anger, kids are egocentric. They internalize everything and they will think it's their fault. They will automatically assume that they've done something wrong. So to catch yourself, oh, that's me being short. It has nothing to do with anything that's going on over here. It has everything to do with what's happening over here, and just to own it. And modeling emotional regulation and interpersonal regulation, and saying when we get into bad spaces, whoops, I made a mistake. Let me give that another shot. I think what we also know about resilience is, two of the main things that drive resilience throughout the entire lifespan is purpose and connection, purpose and connection, purpose and connection. And if we can, sometimes we need to reinvent that based on things that happen in throughout our life's journey. But those are the things, if we have those things intact, we can get through just about anything.
Reinvent the purpose.
So something that we're connected to that's bigger than ourselves.
Okay.
That might be your family. That might be a social cause. That might be, I don't know, something, you know, spiritual realm, something that you feel like your life matters.
Okay.
And for little bitties, that's a hard one, but you can still get connected to that. Like, you matter in this family, you know, you matter in this school. And trying to help kids find the voices, the circumstances where they feel, valued and where that they are growing and, you know, really living into their passions and talents. And then I'm less worried about that than I am the connectedness part. There's a ton of research that's been coming out lately showing that as we get the superficial connections of technology, we are losing the in-depth connections of vulnerability and trust. And it's leaving, it's having a bigger impact on youth than we would have anticipated. So I think we have to have, be very, and then also, you know, the culture sometimes in our kids' worlds where every moment is scheduled and we're all focused on, you know, where they're headed, rather than just creating time for play and connection and all that stuff. So helping children form opportunities for deep relationships where, you know, technology is kind of off the table for a while. I think also, you know, whether that's hiking or in a church group or whatever, where we don't need it. We just absolutely don't even need it. So let's put it down and really focus on one another.
Yeah. The technology, putting that down. It's interesting. It's interesting because what I'm seeing now for myself anyways, as you know, an aging male and one that's lost most of the friendships as, you know, as we do, right? We focus on work. We focus on the family. All of a sudden we find we're like, where'd everybody go? I thought the party was right here.
Right.
And so I find a benefit of the technology and Facebook and those groups, right, to be able to reconnect, to reintegrate. So, with the children.
And let me just pause there. I would say the fatherhood groups do it as good as anybody I've seen. You know, so I think you're also part of a special subculture that's really good at connecting through technology in that more vulnerable way than other men have an opportunity to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's had a profound impact on me, and I'm grateful for it. And I'm grateful to run my own, right? So I run one of my own as well, and being able to find a leadership capacity and just be there for the guys, to not just be like, hey, do what I'm doing or do this, do that, but, you know, just in the sense of showing an openness and accepting others for whatever it is they're doing and going through too. And as for, like I was going to say, that for the kids and all the technology, I agree. Like, I'd like to see them put it down more, but at the same time, I see a lot of benefits, at least you know, if they're reading, or I'd rather see them playing a game than watching a show.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's kind of like a, you know, half dozen one, half dozen the other. But so what you're saying, though, is that they're saying that it's having what are some of the impacts that we can get ahead of then now?
The fear of missing out. So like the Instagram, the perfected thing that we're putting out on Instagram that it's making others feel less than or different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cyberbullying, that kind of thing. The access to really disturbing stuff, you know, that's certainly a parent's role to kind of make sure as best we can, you know, build a better mouse trap, make a smarter mouse is something we can't help, right. But as best we can to keep some barriers in between that and what our kids have access to. You know, when 13 Reasons Why came out this time last year, so 13 Reasons Why, the Netflix series that showed a teenage girl's, the aftermath of her suicide, she sends these tapes to 13 people telling them that they're the reason why she died of suicide. My kids binge watched it before I even knew it was there. And this is something like we talk about in our house all the time. So I made, you know, rapid catch up to try to figure out what the heck they had just dosed themselves with. Because my little world was pretty freaked out by that series. And I get it. I get why they did it. I get, you know, how it did potentially open up conversations and a whole bunch of things that are incredibly difficult for teens. And it was Hollywood production quality. It was compelling, engaging, all of that. But there were some really unsafe pieces of it. And sure enough, what was it, a month ago, we just found out from the CDC that we can isolate that kind of historic event of that series, different from Logic Song, different from the celebrity suicides, that little piece of time. And there was an uptick of youth suicides right around that time that the show was airing. And we had already known that there was an uptick in Google searches for by youth around suicide topics, which isn't necessarily bad if they're searching for help, but they were how-to searches. So so we're bracing ourselves because I'm still not convinced that this second season is going to be better. So stuff like that, all of that kind of toxic influence through technology and social media is the concern. And honestly, there's really, it's here to stay, and it's going to evolve, and it's going to get in our life in all kinds of new ways that we haven't even thought of yet.
Right.
So really the point is not necessarily like it's terrible, you got to take it away, but be mindful of it. Because I just watched, Steven Spielberg's new Ready Player One. And, you know, have you seen this movie? Oh, it just came out. It's about a future world where everybody's just completely engrossed in virtual reality, and the actual reality has kind of gone to hell. And the upshot of it is just like, take a break. You know, every once in a while, take a break and engage with the thing right in front of you, whether that's nature or your family or your friends or whatever. And I think that's the healthy balance.
What so we'll jump into Man Therapy for a second, or Man Therapy. Let's talk a little bit about what service that's providing, and let's just do that.
Sure. So going back to those early days after Carson died and that gap filling perspective, one of the upshots of that was the workplace. The other was the full acknowledgement that we had a branding problem in the world of mental health promotion and suicide prevention, in that it's scary, it's daunting, it's clinical. There's a whole bunch of barriers from regular everyday communication around it. And for what we call double jeopardy men, which is the subgroup of men that's most at risk for suicide, the ones with high risk factors who are also least likely to seek help, our main message, if you're depressed, seek help, was missing them on both accounts. They weren't seeing their emotional experiences through a lens of mental health. They saw it as being overwhelmed. Something outside of me is happening to me, and that's why I feel the way I do. And then, you know, the message of go seek help. No, you know, how is that going to help me? I got to fix my own problem. So we went to town, and we did, our little nonprofit and a full service advertising agency named Cactus and the Colorado Public Health Department's Office of Suicide Prevention. So we had a beautiful little public-private nonprofit partnership that's lasted, you know, over a decade now. And we did in-depth interviews with men who had survived suicide attempts and focus groups with people surrounding men at risk and all of this work. And what came out of all of that was a very different approach to what we had been doing before. So we asked the guys, like, how do we find you? Because you're not going to come to us. And they're like, damn right. How do we find you? What cuts through the clutter in your world that we could actually get a message to you? And then what do you need? Like, how do we give you the thing that would be useful?
Right.
And they told us a whole bunch of stuff, but some of the high points are, give me a chance to figure this out on my own. Give me a tool maybe that I can self-screen to figure out, is this really something I should be worried about or not? And if it turns out that I should be worried about it, give me a path with at least some first steps that I can solve it on my own. And if I can't, then, you know, take me stepwise into things that aren't so scary. So like maybe I can't figure it out on my own, but I try this online thing or I try a peer thing. Take me on some steps before you say I have to go see a professional mental health person, because that just seems so foreign to what I think could be helpful.
Well, we don't go to a doctor to begin with.
Right. No, right.
Not a single one. I mean, because we are invulnerable.
This is true. Right. No, it's the same. It's the same thinking process across all health issues, not just mental health issues. So that was one. Give us a chance to solve it on our own and then let us know when we're in over our heads and then connect us to things you've vetted that are probably going to be working for us. Another one was, this idea of reciprocity, which I find fascinating. So, and I talk about men and women as being so separate, and really we know they're overlapping bell-shaped curves with a lot of people very similar in the middle. But generally speaking, for women, there's not this idea that if you help me, then I have to repay the debt. So we
that doesn't exist for women?
Doesn't exist. No. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we go to a mental health professional and we're done. That's it. We wrote the check. We're done. But for men, like there's this back and forth thing. You know, you help me do this, I help you do that. And you don't get that with this kind of health providing service. You just can't clean the gutters of your therapist. So, however, there are models where this is possible. So I'm a huge, huge fan of peer support for men. Mm-hmm. because it's one of the reasons why in 12-step groups, we see a gender balance. There's equal amounts of men as there are women in 12-step groups. And I believe that's because men go into these relationships and they're like, all right, I'm vulnerable now. I have to reach out and get support. But I know when I'm well, I get to help the folks behind me. Right. And that's not the case in many other scenarios. So reciprocity is one. How do you build in that? The other thing they told us is, show us role models of men with vicarious credibility. I love that phrase. Men maybe like one or two steps above me on my perceived power hierarchy. You know, they got their man card and they're flashing it around and I dig what they're doing. Like, show me that guy. And they've gone through something similar. They've reached out and they're better.
Is that guy a mess? I can be like him? That's great.
I'm listening to what they're doing. But because we asked him, like, is it a celebrity? Is it an avatar? Is it, who is this person that's going to deliver the message? Like, oh, somebody just like me, but that kind
I mean, not to shoot myself in the foot, but like, I think I got a DUI when I was like 21 or 22, I forget. And President Bush had just gone into office. I was like, I could still be president. Right. No problem. We're in good shape.
Right. And then the last thing that I'll share is they said, make it funny. And we were like, oh boy, it's hard enough to talk about this stuff. And then we got to make it funny without offending a whole bunch of people. And they're like, I don't know. That's your job to figure out. So the creative geniuses at Cactus went to town and they, paraded a whole bunch of concepts in front of us. And we're like, nope. Nope. And then finally they came up with man therapy and we're like, that's a winner. So basically what they did is they created a fake therapist, Dr. Rich Mahogany. And I'm thinking we'll have some.
I love it. Of course I've got all these triggers. I told you triggers earlier. You say Rich Mahogany, that's Anchorman, right?
Yep. Yeah. So they pulled from all kinds of kind of humorous portrayals of masculine men for this character. He's manning up mental health and he's fake. Did I mention he doesn't exist? He's just,
you did say that. I was kind of sad, just cause I saw Rich Mahogany and I was like, wait a second. But I want to read one of the things that's right on I'm on the site. It says, welcome to man therapy because you can't just rub some dirt on your emotions. And that's funny. That's great.
Yes. That's Catherine's work right there. They come up with this stuff and they're just brilliant. So we launched summer 2012 with an article in the New York Times. So right out of the gate, we got a huge splash. Then that country of Australia licensed our collateral, and that was super exciting. We've licensed it to a number of states here in the United States, but I still say it's like one of the best kept secrets of what could be so much bigger. Mm-hmm. We're in conversations now with some very exciting national and international partners. So we'll see. We're trying to be patient. But we're pretty proud of the success that we've had. And the things that we've had the most success with are partnerships where we take that man therapy concept and we pull it into a subgroup. So we've done partnerships with male military and veterans groups. We have a whole bunch of collateral just for that. Male first responders, so fire, law enforcement, EMS. And I'm really working on the dads groups. I'm really working. I had a whole bunch at the summit in New Orleans this past February who were like, yeah, let's do it. And then, you got to make it a reality. But I think it's resonated really well with a lot of the fatherhood groups that we've had. And I think if we had some specific father-related material, it could help a lot of guys.
It reminds me of Archer. I don't know if you ever watched the show, like FX Archer. It's just like the manly man, but like therapy for the manly man. Like it says right there again, because you can't just rub some dirt on your emotions, because that's right. What women do. We're like, well, there's
some.
You can't
fix your mental health with duct tape. You can't.
We're good. Yeah. Oh my God. He's not one now, but he's six now. I got one. But he was trying to duct tape for his toy last night that, you know, needed sewing. I was like, dude, what are you doing? He goes, I'm duct taping Lizzie. I'm like, well, he needs to be sewing up, brother. Anyways, sorry. Continue.
Yeah, so other places that we've had success is construction industry. Really resonates with them. They actually hang that. You can't fix your mental health with duct tape posters in their work trailers and hard hat stickers and all that kind of stuff. Another group that we're looking forward to maybe partnering with is Native Men. So we've been approached by a number of tribal communities to create some special things for them.
Sure.
And before we actually go out and do anything, we spend a lot of time listening. And that's what makes it work, is that we listen to what's funny within those cultures, where their pain points are, what kind of resources we need to provide. We gather those stories. So Man Therapy also has a whole video library of real guys telling real stories. And so that by the time we deliver the thing that we're working on together, the community that we're trying to serve is like, you got us. That's awesome. I'm like,
that's great.
Because you told us what to do. And we So anyway, for all the fatherhood folks out there listening, come on, let's make this a reality.
Yeah.
It'd be super fun to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's at mantherapy.org. We've covered quite a bit of territory today. I would love to go over more, but right now I'm just going to flip it over to fatherhood.
Sure.
And like I said at the beginning, you know, kind of tell me, like, what do you think, like, the purpose of fatherhood is?
Woo. All right. The purpose of fatherhood. This is deep, Brandon. Okay.
You're in Colorado. You get this stuff all the time.
I know. I've never really strategically thought it through, though. I think it's, it's a foundational pillar of family. It's a place where, and I think, there are continuums of both genders that have fatherhood stuff. I mean, I'm the provider in my family right now, and I feel like father, you know, a lot of times, like showing up and paying the bills and that kind of thing. So I think that, I guess that's how I'm going to say it. It's the pillar of a foundation of family.
What would you say the difference between, I don't get to interview too many mothers, so what would you say the difference is between a father and a mother in the same context?
So that's very interesting. Also, since my family has flipped traditional gender roles, my husband stays home, I work and bring home the bacon, and we get pushed back on that. Overlapping bell-shaped curves, a lot of folks in the middle doing both stereotypical expectations as well. I even like the nurturing expectation kind of gender split is split in my house. So my husband's much more of the, let's sit down and rest and recover. And I'm like, how are your grades? What's your time on that lap? You know.
That's great.
So I don't know. So we balance each other out. I guess that is the upshot of that, is that it's important to have a balance of those different types of roles, regardless of which gender is participating in them, the nurturing side and the kind of living into expectation side. They're not
living into expectations. I got you. I got you. You talked about your father for a moment there. What's your relationship with him like? And like, how pivotal was he in where you are today?
Oh gosh. So I did tell you that also before we started this recording, that this is a deep and complex question for me. So, my dad's honestly reason for living was to see my brother to adulthood. My brother and I were both pretty rebellious teens, but my brother like way worse than me. So as long as I got straight A's, nobody really bothered me. So I was kind of like, oh, she's fine. But my brother was like the focus of my dad's attention, and my dad's mission was to keep him going to really an extraordinary adulthood. So my brother got into the college that my father went to, graduated from that college, even though he got kicked out for a year, you know, married, had a family, started this national insurance company, and my father went, did it. And then my brother died. So, no, you know, of course, he never saw that coming. And then my work, my entire work is around this part of our family story. So I think for my whole life, I've had father hunger, the upshot of that.
Sure.
And my father has been an amazing man. You know, he was one of these babies born out of the Depression era. So very much responsible and self-sacrificial for his family forever. You know, he was in the insurance industry, started off, I think, partly because almost entirely because it was the right thing to do. You share the risk of a community so that people can get through their hard times. And at some point in his career, it flipped into this huge money-making thing that he was like, So he retired at like 52. And at almost 51 now, I'm like, what? How is that possible? Right. But that's how responsible he was. He saved. He worked. And he, for the most part, was not happy. So my relationship right now, we're working on it. I long for the commonalities that we have, which are not many. And when I find one, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm grabbing it and I'm holding onto it. Like, we both like to go to jazz concerts. Yay. So, you know, every once in a while, I'm like, oh, special time with my dad. But it's, you know, it's hard. He comes from a different era. And he's actually now refinding himself and a purpose, going back to that purpose thing, with the grandkids. So he's very involved in my kids' life, in my nieces and nephews' lives, as kind of continuing that, I'm going to bring these kids into, you know, fully fledged adulthood. So, cool. There you go.
Cool. What's a book that's had the most impact on you in maybe the past 2 years, one or two books?
I'm actually reading a book right now called Owning Bipolar. Mm-hmm. And so it just got me thinking, you know, most of the book is written, I would say, in a way of like, how do you manage your illness like you would other types of chronic conditions? And, you know, I think of myself as being on the bipolar spectrum on the low end. And that's mostly because I don't want to discount the suffering that is happening for people who have more intense forms. But I do feel like, you know, it's part of who I am. And honestly, just like my brother, the upsides are where my gifts lie. So owning that, managing that, taking care of myself so that those gifts stay and I don't have to go through that depression again, or be disrupted in where I can't provide for my family or do the things that that are really important for me. That's the part I kind of have to think about every day, owning that and managing it. I think the other thing that's been kind of a nice thing to read this year was a good friend of mine wrote a quasi-memoir kind of non-fictional, historical fiction kind of thing about her teenage years and losing a good friend to suicide. Mm. And she wrote very, very well about seeing that through a teen's eyes. And now having these wonderful teen humans in my house and reading this book and kind of remembering what it's like to be a teenager and how difficult so many of these things are to figure out, especially relationship-wise. It's just kind of given the insight, both to my own teenage years as well as to my kiddos. And so I just really want to commend her for taking that opportunity to write for teens about something as difficult as losing a friend to suicide.
Is that available? What's the name of that book?
It's not. She's going through some final editing right now, and it should be, I'm guessing it's going to be out probably by September.
Okay. Cool. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Those are not ones that usually make the list, Sally. and so I appreciate that. What is something that you'd like to thank your children for?
You know, I do these little gratitude reflection. So every day I'm the early riser of the family because that's my time. And I get up, you know, 4:30 or 5 in the morning. It's still dark. And I used to have two dogs. Now I have one. I walk the dog. And that's like my spiritual practice of the day. So I have the stars and the dirt road and the dog. And I do all my gratitude rituals. And top of my list are my kids. And I, they are really my reason for being here, the joy of my life. And they are, they're all so different. It's that it's miraculous to me that they came from the same set of parents. So my oldest is an 80-year-old wise soul. So I'm very grateful for his gentleness. He's 6'2", like strapping huge kiddo, but he's got, you know, the Zen-centeredness of a very old person. And he's just calm and loving. And I remember, you know, a couple of my little Nicholas's stories that when he was like 3, he would walk across the parking lot to see this other kid who was walking by herself, and he'd just grab her hand and like, hello, I'm Nicholas. And then when he was racing in his swimming, he would get off the blocks, knew how to dive off the blocks, but he would get off them if the kids next to them were not on the blocks because he didn't want them to be intimidated. Like, that's that kid. So I'm grateful for all the lessons he teaches me on connecting and kindness. Honestly, he's just so kind. And then Tanner is just, he's my 17-year-old, and he's probably like of the three of them, the mini me. So I'm grateful for, connecting with me because, being self-employed, I had the opportunity to take some time and travel with him. And so I'm very grateful that he likes to be with me and that we got to spend 3 weeks on the road this spring. How lucky am I? One-on-one time with my 17-year-old, exploring colleges and just hanging out.
Right on.
And then my baby's just, I guess, prototypical youngest. He's definitely carving out his own path. So I'm grateful for all the ways that he teaches me to, not to fall into the herd.
I love it. Not to fall into the herd. Very cool. It's amazing, absolutely, how different they are, even though they kind of come up in the same place, right?
Yeah, I know. Completely different.
I love it. Anything else you want to hit on today?
I think we covered a lot of ground, so I don't have any burning things that I want to make sure that we share. I think we've got it. I look forward to seeing how this plays out, and I will love to connect it to other audiences that I have, because obviously the fatherhood pockets that both you and I are involved in, I think would be excited to hear it. But I could also think of, my construction guys and my first responders, who many of them, most of them are also fathers,
right.
Who I think would really appreciate not just this, but all the work that you're doing. So thank you for inviting me. I'm very grateful.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to have you. Now, where can I send people to go find out more about you?
So the easiest way is my website, sallyspencerthomas.com. I'm on most social media platforms except Snapchat. I hate Snapchat. But on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn.
It's never going to catch.
I can't do it. Every time I'm like, oh, geez, how do you just post a thing? Like, why is it so hard?
Right.
But
awesome. Well, Sally, thanks again.